This programme was produced at and first aired on MPR, Manawatu People's Radio, with support from New Zealand On Air. Ka pai, irirangi te motu, MPR. If you're enjoying this podcast in Manawatu, you could make your very own, just like this one. MPR exists to help people like you tell your story or share your passion on air and online. Check out mpr.nz for more information.
Welcome to Manawatu Conversations, recollections of the past and sometimes opinions about the future. Today I have with me...
Mickey Tyler.
And I'm Stuart Burks. Now, Mickey, you've been involved with the Medical Museum in Palmerston North.
I have, Stuart. And sadly, we are no longer able to have a presence at the Palmerston North Hospital because the building that we were using, unfortunately, has had to be demolished to make room for a new substation for the new mental health block that's being built up at the Palmerston North Hospital. So at the moment, we have a lot of our lovely things stored in very safekeeping, in the hope that one day we will be able to get them all out again and display them.
But you have a few cabinets available in there.
We do. Still have a presence at the hospital itself by way of cabinets throughout the hospital, which we have loaded up with some of our special exhibits so that people can at least still have a look at those. But the medical museum itself was actually on the hospital grounds by grace and favour of and a lot of cooperation from the hospital staff from the early, 1980s. Dr. David Warnock, who was a retired ophthalmologist, was given space in the basement at the hospital because he was a passionate collector of medical memorabilia, and he had nowhere, he didn't know what quite to do with this, so they gave him some space in the hospital, along with a collection from Dr. Neil Little, who was a ear, nose, and throat specialist, and he had a very nice collection as well. So the museum itself was called the Medical Museum with the Neil Little collection when it first started. But this was how David introduced the cabinets throughout the hospital so that people could view some of the lovely things that they had, that we had with it. I say we had because we still have them, but we don't have them on display anymore. But I'll be saying have and had quite a bit, probably. However, that was in 1980. In 2006, David was offered the use of one of the mental health buildings that was no longer required. So he grabbed it with open arms, and the hospital staff were very, very good, the orderlies, everybody, in helping him move everything over to where it was until June of last year. That was when we finally vacated. But in 2007, a year after he moved there, it became open to the public. And from then on, we could have anyone and everyone calling in to have a look at the huge amount of history that we had there relating to the Palmerston North Hospital and beyond. But we asked was a gold coin donation, but we were put on the list of places to visit in Palmerston North for groups coming here. Groups of people might have been Rotary, gardening groups, all sorts of groups who would come to Palmerston for the day, and they would go to the places like the Wildlife Centre and of course the Medical Museum was listed then, and they thoroughly enjoyed it and said we had no idea about all this, we had no idea that it was even here. So it was, but there's a huge amount of history there relating to Palmerston North.
So, I've been there myself with a group. The thing that stood out for me was the iron lung from polio.
Yes, the iron lung is an amazing, amazing thing that saved a lot of people's lives. It didn't cure people, but it helped people during the polio epidemics, people whose chest muscles were affected, and it enabled them to be able to breathe with the use of bellows that were electrically worked within this iron lung. The iron lung that we had at the museum was actually a prototype built by the Both brothers in Australia as a prototype, and it was very much, very, very much cheaper to build than the iron ones.
Mm-hmm.
But it was copied and built, you know, from, okay. As I say, it was a prototype. But that iron lung, you may or may not realise, has been around the country because Rotary, along with the Gates Foundation, have been involved in eliminating polio in just about, well, all...
Yes, around, they're trying to get the global elimination of polio.
All but two countries in the world, Pakistan and Afghanistan, I understand, when I last was told about that. But so for Rotary...
Yes, it's a major campaign that they've had for some time.
Yes, absolutely. And at some of their annual meetings, it's gone to New Plymouth a couple of times and it's been to Whanganui, but we got to the stage where we felt we couldn't send it off anywhere anymore because it was getting... The poor man inside, it was getting a bit tired.
I had a dummy in there.
Yes, but a lady called June Opie was in that iron lung for quite some time and she wrote a book over my dead body.
Oh, right.
And she's in her book, she said it was like a coffin on wheels, but she was in awe of it to start with, but she said it absolutely enabled her to go on living because they were allowed out for about 5 minutes at a time, but had to go back in, otherwise they just simply couldn't breathe. But no, Whanganui actually had a whole ward of iron lungs over there.
That's right, yes. That was the Duncan family, I think.
That's right, it was. Yes. You're correct.
Yeah.
But
and then it moved out when polio, sort of, the number of cases sort of went right down, so they used it for something else. But now there's the problem of post-polio. Mervyn Dykes, who's written for local papers, and he's got a short book that he wrote about his experience with polio.
Right, yes. Well, he has the post-polio syndrome, doesn't he?
Yes,
I have heard him speak about that. But the Rotary group have done an amazing job with that. They really have.
Yeah. Well, I was in a Rotary club, and several of the members actually had polio when they were young, and it was that generation.
Yes.
And it was very scary. There were times when they wouldn't let children go to school because they might catch polio.
Correct. That's right. So, yes. And our children were vaccinated, but it was a cruel, horrible thing. I wonder if we'll be able to do this with COVID and eliminate it.
They say no. It's more likely to become milder rather than. Because it's I think there's some link. It's a bit like some of the flu viruses and things. And at first, as it was something new, and they didn't know how it was spread, and bodies weren't used to it. But now, you know, several people overseas, at least, have had COVID three or four times.
Yeah, so. Different strains keep popping up, don't they?
Yeah. But that's a bit like the cold and the flu. I think you get different flu strains each year. And if you go back 100 years, flu was a major killer after World War I.
Absolutely.
The flu epidemic. Okay, so I mean, that was something that stood out for me, but there's lots of other things that you had in the museum, didn't you?
Yes, we certainly did. We had several sections in the museum, an extensive collection of medical instruments and equipment, including we had an orthopaedic section, we had, as I've told you, the Neil Little collection of ear, nose and throat things, big trumpets that people first started using for hearing aids, which was just amazing to how far we've come. But we had a mock surgery set up operating theatre set up there, and we had a model sitting on the end of the operating table with one arm on one knee looking at you saying, "I'm okay, come on in," you know. But if you could see the anaesthetic equipment in particular that was used in days like that, you would just be very grateful that you have to have, if you have to have an operation, it's now and not earlier on, because it was pretty barbaric.
Well, it was worse before anaesthetics, but but the early things.
It had the same effect. They put you to sleep and they woke you up. So as long as the job was done while you were...
Well, I hear, though, isn't it? At one stage, you had, if they used anaesthetic, you had to stay in hospital for several days to make sure you got out of it okay. And apparently, it's maybe especially for older people, it can affect the brain longer term. But now a lot of the anaesthetics, they use less anaesthetic and more other things, and they monitor... In fact, I think, didn't John Sendell say, as an anaesthetist... Early on, you'd be looking at the patient to try and see, you know, are they turning blue? That means they need more something. Whereas now it's all monitored in far more detail.
That's what's happened over the last 100 years. You know, there's been so much progress with techniques. And as you say, I think that was very common with just about everything. You stayed in hospital for so long after any procedure, and now they can send you home in the middle of the night.
But people are recovering so much faster as well.
Yes.
But you haven't mentioned, but you worked as a dental nurse, and I know you've shown what the old foot treadle drill is. And comparing that to modern drills and
absolutely. Yes, I was lucky enough to. Were fortunate enough to work through from treadle drill to high speed drill.
Okay. Now, first of all, the treadle drill, because probably a lot of people now, unless they're sort of 70 or 80, wouldn't know what one of those is.
No. Well, it was a little bit like your mother's old sewing machine, treadle sewing machine.
Yes.
You had to pedal it, and it had a cord and a duplex spring.
So there's a sort of foot pedal that you just stand on, push down and lift up and push down again.
Yes, one foot.
So you're trying to do that while you're holding your hand still with the drill in it?
You are. And this is why early dental clinics got the name of being the murder house, because it was the vibration that was so terrible. I likened the old drill. This is in the... event of the new drill.
You're going back to when, the 1950s?
Yes, the 50s. I trained in the early 50s, and there was just no other way. But the vibration was the part that was so horrible. It really was. And I likened it, as I say, to a road drill.
Was the vibration painful, or you just, or just psychologically?
Both. I think any dental drilling in those days was painful on our part, because we were not allowed to use local anaesthetic.
As dental nurses? Is it school dental nurses?
School dental nurse.
Okay.
But for conservative work, we were not allowed to use local anaesthetic.
Conservative means to conserve the teeth rather than pulling
the tooth. But for extractions, pulling the teeth out, yes, we did use local anaesthetic. But we didn't use nerve blocks, which would block off the whole side of the mouth until the 70s, because there was always a risk of paralysing the facial nerve if you got into the wrong place. But I mean, there's a risk with any injection in any part of the body. But
So these were sort of 5-year-old children having teeth drilled without.
Those were their first teeth, but a lot of that, it was right through. Yeah. It was right through. Yeah. Young New Zealanders had some of the worst teeth in the world.
And that was because of lack of fluoride in the water?
There was no fluoride found naturally in our water supplies, in our ground, levels. With the advent of fluoride, it certainly made a huge difference. Yeah. But we still have a problem now with the high sugar drinks.
And yes, that's right.
They are so acidic that they are dissolving some of the first teeth. And there are still a waiting list at the hospital for young children, preschoolers, to have a full clearance, have all their teeth removed.
Oh, wow.
And this makes...
So what do the parents do? They just think, this is what children drink?
Yes, well, unfortunately, you know, if home situation's not good, yes, and you want to get the child to bed without them crying, they're given a sweet drink to go in their bottles, or they're given dummies with honey on and that sort of thing. I have sat with mothers of children who've come out of the general anaesthetic having had their teeth removed, and the mothers are distraught. I've shown them videos, given them all the information, and in 2 years' time they're back with the next one. So I think a lot of it is circumstantial.
Yeah.
But it's not that they don't know, because the Plunket are very good about.
Yes.
Well, I'm not sure whether they still have Plunket as such, but they do certainly.
Yeah, that's the Plunket nurses going into the home with
young
mothers.
Yes, I don't think that now, but I think that they do have the opportunity to talk with people when the children are young, and they are all given the right advice, and they're given pamphlets, but I think it's just...
If it's the norm, and if everybody's doing it, then you carry on.
Circumstances at home, I think, come into it a lot, and you know, Dad comes home and he's been out with the boys, and you know, we wouldn't know. But however, we're keeping on top of it as far as the permanent dentition go. And when I say we were fortunate in Palmerston North. Another dental therapist and I started the first adolescent dental service.
Now you say dental therapist.
Well, this would be 20 years ago, 25, 30 years ago. The name was changed from dental nurse to dental therapist because we were not nurses.
Okay.
And it took them a long time to realise.
So you counsel the teeth then?
Counsel the teeth, But we took the first adolescent mobile unit into the high schools in Palmerston North, the first in New Zealand, because we realised that there were so many adolescents under 18, because it was free dental care until 18, even though they'd gone to high school. They had to visit a contracting dentist in town, and they just wouldn't go. A lot of them wouldn't go, and they didn't have the support of their parents to get them there. But once they saw someone come and go into the mobile, came back in quite happily with a smile on their face, almost.
And that was because you had more efficient drills, faster drills?
Oh, yes. Well, that had happened a lot earlier. Okay. But
so when were these mobile?
1993. We started the first one, went into Awatapu College.
Okay.
Yeah. Yes. And
now, also, what was the policy with... So you've got a child and you see some decay. Do you say, well, it's just small, we'll leave it? Or do you treat every...
Very early decay. And even as a prevention, a fluoride application can be given and is in a high-risk mouth. Yes.
So would that stay if you do fluoride application?
No. Not much different to putting a bit of toothpaste on.
Okay.
But it does... It is absorbed into the enamel, which is porous.
Yes,
and it will give it some resistance to the acid from the sugars. Yes. No, it's been a very good... Can I tell my little story about the little boy?
Yes, of course,
you do that. Going back to telling you about the fact that we were not allowed to use local anaesthetic for conservative work. This was an extraction. But this little boy had an abscessed tooth. And local anaesthetic, even though we were able to give it, is not effective in tissue that's inflamed.
Okay.
So it wouldn't have been totally anaesthetised, but it had been very, very sore for him, obviously, being abscessed. Anyway, I managed to take this tooth out for this little boy, and it's because... A five-year-old and a molar on a five-year-old is quite significant.
Would that have actually come through?
Yes. They get their first permanent teeth at six.
Okay. Yep.
And but this one, you know, they have quite big roots, quite surprisingly. However, long story cut short, I got the tooth out, and this little boy just sat there. He was absolutely wonderful. And without hesitation, I just put my arm around him and said, "You have been so good." We always had a little butterfly or something that we made to give them to take home. But I said, "You have just been amazing. I could have you for my little boy." Well, little did I know that when I arrived at the clinic the next morning, he was sitting on the doorstep with his little suitcase and his teddy bear. And he said to me, "Mum said you can have me."
Did she come and claim him back afterwards?
Telephone rang and Mum had it all jacked up. So we did have our moments of good things. Yeah. They weren't all bad.
We
did get some lovely thank yous from people, even though nobody really loves going to the dentist. I don't think I've ever heard anybody say how much they enjoy the dentist. Yeah. But however, I mean, it's like anything else now, it's pretty pain-free. Yeah.
Well, I did find my teenage years, so you're going back to the 1960s, and I went to a dentist, and so we were just chatting while I was doing things, and I asked him what made him go into dentistry, and he said, "Because he likes meeting people." And I thought, you're not meeting them under the best possible circumstances.
And the thing I still find difficult is that, well, my dentist has retired now, but I knew him very well. And you could have no conversation with him. And he'd keep asking me things, and there I am, you know, with my mouth wide open, and couldn't respond.
Yes. Well, I found it's been very interesting that my dentist retired just a few years ago. And I would go to him, and he'd have a look, check the teeth, and, "Well, we'll keep an eye on that. It might be a problem, and then I'll clean your teeth." He'd ask me about the share market and so on, and then we'd finish, and you just pay a price, and everything done for a year, a relatively low price. He retired. We got new dentists and dental hygienists and a whole new mass of equipment. The price of the checkup more than doubled, and then you pay even more than that to go to a separate dental hygienist to clean your teeth. I think you've probably done better and with better equipment, but
I think it's very interesting, because the school dental nurse training, as it was in the training schools. I trained in Wellington. There was that was the only training school when I started, but Auckland started and had a training school briefly for a while, and then Christchurch also. They all closed down, and Wellington continued for a few years before it was taken over by the Polytech. And then after the Polytech said enough of that, it went to Otago and became a degree. And it became a degree with a dual qualification of both dental hygienist and dental therapist.
Okay.
So they could choose when they graduated whether they wanted to apply for a job as a hygienist or a job as a dental therapist.
Okay.
And a lot of them went to the bigger cities because there were more dentists requiring more hygienists.
And there's now there seems to be, am I right in thinking there's more emphasis on gum health?
As you get older, definitely.
But was that when you were young, or is there also emphasis on gum health?
Yes, well, that's why so many people had dentures at an early age, not because of tooth decay, but because of gum disease.
Okay.
And the gums just wouldn't hold the teeth in place. You know, I've seen adults with permanent teeth that were just quite mobile. And of course then they a vicious circle, because they couldn't eat anything hard or fruit or anything like that. It had to be all mush, and they were glad to get rid of them. I think the advent of electric toothbrushes has been a good thing, because a lot of people, unfortunately, this sounds like a dental health lecture, but unfortunately, people got hold of their toothbrush and they got a hard bristle brush, as hard as they could, and they scrubbed. They didn't brush, they scrubbed. And they virtually scrubbed their gums away until the roots became visible, and then the food impacted, And away it went.
Yeah. And now there's all the flossing and getting things out between the teeth, which I don't recall from, you know, you go back, I don't, you know, a few decades anyway.
No.
It wouldn't have been something people would have
known. No. But there's certainly the emphasis now is on keeping your teeth.
Yes.
But the emphasis in way back, and I'm talking about very earlier days, it was about, you know, it was quite the norm to have teeth out, have all your teeth out.
Now, so I've heard anecdotal, well, not just, I know people who, when they were in their late teens, early 20s, sometimes you're turning 21 or you're going to get married, as a present, have all your teeth
That's
out.
That's right.
Was that common?
Not here. But as I think I might have mentioned, that our grandson brought home a girl from Norway, and she told me that they—that was the norm over there. But the English generally coming to New Zealand had better teeth than the New Zealanders for a while.
I think that was partly with fluoride, maybe,
I think
also for a certain generation, my generation, because I grew up in England, and you had rationing during the war, and that sort of carried through into, say, 1950s with school dinners and so on, and it was a relatively healthy, relatively low sugar diet.
Well, we had that too. We did have that, and I remember clearly, as a present or as a reward, one day I was given threepence to go and buy some sweets, and the only thing I could buy was a chocolate fish. But I think it was a lot of it wasn't so much diet, because we all grew our own vegetables and things then, and we didn't rush off to the supermarket. Yeah. And
I see the problem now, because when I was young, you can get a sort of biscuit covered in chocolate, and when I was young, you get them individually wrapped, and maybe once a month as a special treat, have one. Now you buy a whole packet of those that are open on the table, and every time you walk past, you have another one.
Yes. I think that totally adds to the fact that we have a lot of obese people too.
Absolutely.
Doesn't
it? Yes, I think so.
You know, and I think sugar consumption is huge.
Yes.
We're not going to have these big people that we've got without them having a very high sugar diet.
Sugar, fats and salt.
And fast foods.
This is part one of two. Listen next week for part two. Thank you for listening to Manawatu Conversations. This and other recent programs can also be found on the Manawatu People's Radio website, and a range of programs is also available on the Manawatu Heritage website of the Palmerston North City Archive. The address for that is manawatuheritage.pncc.govt.nz.
If you enjoy this NPR podcast, please consider subscribing. Our podcasts are available on all major podcasting platforms, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Spotify, as well as the accessmedia.nz app. Support this show and others like it by giving a donation. For more information, go to www.npr.nz/donate.